This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lin-Manuel Miranda, created the hip-hop musical Hamilton, the Broadway phenomenon about the Founding Fathers. He wrote the book, music, and lyrics, and starred as Alexander Hamilton in the original production. If you haven't been able to see it on stage, or were hoping to see it again, you can now watch a filmed version of the original Broadway production on Disney+. It was shot in June 2016. The film was supposed to be released in theaters in October 2021, but it was pushed up because of the pandemic. After all, who knows when theaters will fully reopen, and we all need good things to watch now. Hamilton set records for ticket sales. It just passed $1 billion in global revenue. It won 11 Tonys, a Pulitzer Prize for drama, and the cast recording won a Grammy. Miranda's first musical, In the Heights, has been adapted into a film, but because of the pandemic, its release has been postponed. Miranda is in the process of directing his first film, an adaptation of Tick, Tick, Boom, the first musical by Jonathan Larson, who became posthumously famous for his musical Rent. Production was halted on that because of the pandemic. A documentary about the improv music group that Miranda co-founded in 2005, Freestyle Love Supreme, will start streaming on Hulu July 17th. Let's start with a track from the original cast recording of Hamilton. The song is The Room Where It Happens, and it appears to have inspired the title of John Bolton's new memoir, The Room Where It Happened, in which Bolton lays out all the reasons, beyond Ukraine, why Trump should have been impeached. Here's Leslie Odom Jr. as Aaron Burr and Lin-Manuel Miranda as Alexander Hamilton.
Ah, Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Burr.
Sir. And did you hear the news about good old General Mercer?
No.
You know Claremont Street?
Yeah.
They renamed it after him. The Mercer legacy is secure.
Sure.
And all he had to do was die.
Yeah, that's a lot less work.
We ought to give it a try. Now, how you gonna get your debt plan through?
I guess I'm gonna finally have to listen to you.
Really?
Talk less. Smile more. Do whatever it takes to get my plan on the Congress floor.
Now Madison and Jefferson are merciless.
Well, hate the sin, love the sinner.
Hamilton.
I'm sorry, Burr, I gotta go.
But
decisions are happening over dinner.
Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room.
Diametrically opposed foes.
They emerged with a compromise, having opened doors that were
previously closed.
The immigrant emerges with unprecedented financial power, a system he can shape however he wants. The Virginians emerge with the nation's capital. And here's the pièce de résistance. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is really a pleasure to have you back on our show.
Thank you. Great to be back.
So The Room Where It Happens is about Hamilton kind of compromising with the South. He gets to put some of his financial plans into effect, and the South gets to choose where the capital is going to be. How did you find out that The Room Where It Happens inspired the title of John Bolton's memoir?
Well, listen, I'm not 100% certain that it did. I'm certainly not the first person to put those words in that order, although I would argue that I made it a song you could dance to pretty nicely. But I think I learned about it when it was leaked that he was writing a memoir. As far as I'm concerned, The Room Where It Happened for Bolton should have been in front of Congress when all of the things in this book would have been a lot more useful. But here we are.
I'm thinking, what are your other most quoted lines from the show? I'm thinking, talk less, smile more. Dying is easy, living is harder. What else?
That's another one that politicians seem to really relate to, or gets thrown at politicians. Talk less, smile more. I've been heartened in seeing sort of the Black Lives Matter protests all over the country. I'm past patiently waiting. History has its eyes on you. What I've learned is that when you write a musical, and it's a musical, that brushes against sort of the origins of this country, like, it's always going to be relevant, because the only real insight of the show is that the fights we had at the origin are the fights we're still having. And so the contradictions inherent in our country are always going to be relevant. And so different lyrics resonate in different ways. I remember going to see the show in London in the grip of Brexit. And when King George sang What Comes Next, it hit different. It just landed on that audience with an oof in a way that it didn't. And I feel like the show continues to do that because it is about, because the past isn't done with us ever, ever, ever.
So when you see the 2016 production now, the one that's filmed, what does it make you think about seeing the original cast and a slightly younger version of yourself, a younger version of the production?
It's a weird bit of double vision for me, to be honest. One, I'm so intensely proud of this company and all the things they've gone on to do since. When you watch this movie, you'll see it's not an accident that so many of our original cast have gone on to greater success in film and television, because they are acting to fill the Richard Rodgers Theater, and it works in a close-up with the camera 2 inches from your face. And the movie captures what it felt. You know, it's not a definitive production of a live Hamilton, but it is a snapshot of what it felt like with that company at the end of June of 2016. And then when it comes to looking at myself, I see me at maybe my most tired I've ever been. We're literally shooting an independent movie in between our 8-show-a-week schedule. We filmed a Sunday matinee, filmed all night Sunday, filmed all day Monday, filmed all day Tuesday morning, and then put the cameras in different positions and filmed the Tuesday night show. It was a 3-day film shoot.
You look at yourself and see how tired you were?
Yeah, I think I look more rested now on the other side of 40 than I did in 2016 when I had a newborn child, was still doing like live Ham for Ham shows. There were these live shows we used to do outside the theater for the folks who were trying to get lottery tickets to the two front rows, and the 7-show-a-week schedule and, life. I still don't know how I came out on the other side of that year intact. Actually, I do know. My incredible wife holding down the fort is how I came out on the other side of that show intact.
So Hamilton is in part about who gets to tell the story, because the person telling the story decides who are the major characters, who are the heroes, who are the villains. Why did you want to be the person telling Hamilton's story?
When I picked up Ron Chernow's book, I simply didn't know that Hamilton, alone among the founders, was the one who came from somewhere else. He grew up in the Caribbean with a Dickensian childhood and then wrote his way to the mainland, wrote his way into the American Revolutionary War, wrote his way into the first cabinet, wrote his way into trouble, wrote his way into his duel. So this is an immigrant narrative. And I understood that because I'd written about that a bit with my first show, In the Heights, and I grew up in an immigrant community. And we know that the deal is, if we come to this country, we got to work 3 times as hard just to get a foothold. And so I suddenly understood his story in a Kishka's kind of way in my gut, because I know that story well. It's not just that he wrote the Federalist Papers and the vast majority of the Federalist Papers with James Madison and John Jay, which are the closest we have to like a Kabbalah about the Constitution. It's what the intent was. It was a defense of it so that the states would ratify it. So it is the first legalistic interpretation of our founding documents. He founds the Coast Guard. He founds the New York Post. He founds, so many things. And I think my feeling when I was reading his biography was like, why is the only thing I know about him is that he died in a duel? So again, what I keyed in on was the relentlessness, was how is there 3 lifetimes of work coming from this one guy who died in his 40s? And I'm drawn to those. I mean, I'm drawn to the Jonathan Larsons of the world who hear the ticking clock louder than other folks.
Gee, does this relate to how hard you work? I mean, you were just talking about all the things you were doing when Hamilton was filmed and how exhausted you were. Do you feel that ticking clock too?
I think I feel that ticking clock very acutely. And I think that part of that's just being a New Yorker. I think part of that is an early awareness of mortality, which, you know, I had at a pretty young age. And in a lot of ways, it's funny, I was talking to someone else about how when you start writing something, you think it's about one thing, and then it starts telling you what it's really about. And that happens on everything I've written that's any good. And my sensation on Hamilton with that was, as I began to write Hamilton and I began to write Burr, they have fundamentally different approaches to the ticking clock. Burr, for the most part, is paralyzed by it because he comes from a legacy. He came from very accomplished parents, a famous grandfather, and he's paralyzed with what to do with that time. And Hamilton hears the ticking clock as, I got to get as much done as I can, good, bad, or indifferent. And Burr learns from Hamilton, in my version of the show, I can't speak to reality. In my version of the show, Burr learns to put himself in the arena from Hamilton. Hamilton steps away from the arena in the face of loss. And at the moment when they least act like themselves, when Hamilton is cautious and Burr is reckless, one kills the other, and that's how they're remembered forever.
One of the great things that Hamilton accomplished is giving great parts to African-American actors and other people of color who might not have gotten major roles in other productions. A lot of productions don't have opportunities for people of color, and even with colorblind casting, it doesn't mean it's going to be equal in the casting. Was that an issue for you when you were trying to find a place for yourself on Broadway? I mean, you found your place through writing In the Heights, you know, and then giving yourself a big part in it.
Listen, I'm a musical theater composer because I couldn't be just a musical theater actor. If I had settled for being a musical theater actor, I'd be hopefully auditioning for a bus and truck of West Side Story somewhere. And just like the mortality landed on me early, like at the end of high school, the realization landed on me early, like there's no life for you in musical theater because there are no parts. And In the Heights really came out of a result of seeing, writing what I saw as missing in the musical theater canon for Latinos, just, and really as simple as, can we not be holding knives in a gang in the 50s? Because that exists. And like, what do we have to show for it nearly 50 years later? Every time I write a piece of theater, I'm trying to get us on the board. And that continued with Hamilton, of how can we write the parts that I didn't see existing. Really, the only thing I saw that really gave me permission to write musicals was Rent, which was an incredibly diverse cast. And I went from being a fan of musicals to writing musicals when I saw that show, because it was the thing that gave me permission and gave and was it was contemporary, and it had Latino actors and Black actors, and it told me, you're allowed to write what you know into a show. No other musical had told me that. By the time I'm in my teens, remember, Terry, Chorus Line's already a period piece.
Yeah.
So it was truly the first contemporary musical I'd seen, and I think got me from being a kid who was in school musicals and loved them, but just thought they were written by other people, like by like old white people on the Upper East Side, to giving me permission.
The context of every story we hear kind of depends on when we hear it. And you were getting to that a little bit earlier and talking about seeing Hamilton in London during the whole Brexit debate. So looking at Hamilton like right now, where we're in the middle of a pandemic, and also it's a period of protests against racial inequality in the justice system, systemic racial inequality in the police and how people of color are treated. There's a growing discussion about slavery as being like the original sin in the United States. So when you look at Hamilton through the perspective of like right now, are there any things that you see different in it?
I do think that there are things that hit differently. I've always sort of said that slavery is the original sin of this country. It's in the third line of our show. It's a system in which every character in our show is complicit in some way or another. And again, I think different things resonate differently. Hamilton, although he voiced anti-slavery beliefs, remained complicit in the system. And other than calling out Jefferson on his hypocrisy with regards to slavery in Act Two, doesn't really say much else over the course of Act Two. And I think that's actually pretty honest. Like, he didn't really do much about it. None of them did. None of them did enough. And we say that too in the final moments of the song. So that hits differently now because we're having a conversation. We're having a real reckoning of how do you uproot an original sin? And that's the conversation that I feel like is happening right now.
So one of the key things about Hamilton is the whole cast is that they're African-American or other people of color. And so it's a really like different twist on the white founding fathers who were slaveholders, or at least mostly were slaveholders. So why did you want to give it that twist? And what meaning does that give to the American origin story?
Yeah, well, it's you say twist, but it was also caught up in the initial impulse of the idea itself, the notion that hip-hop was uniquely suited to telling the story, to telling Hamilton's immigrant narrative. I never pictured the literal founders. We're having so many conversations about the iconography of the founders. I'm not interested in statues. I'm not interested in how they look on our money. I was picturing Hamilton as a hip-hop artist. And then as a result, as I'm reading Ron's book, my brain is mining it for who are the hip-hop and R&B voices that can sort of tell these strands of the story. And then I think it's incredibly meaningful to then populate our live show with black and brown artists. One, because hip-hop is a black art form. It was created by blacks and Latinos in the South Bronx in the 70s. And it's a love letter to that art form, just as much as it's a love letter to musical theater. And also, it's our country too. The line we've always said is, this is a story of America then told by America now. But to dig deeper and interrogate that a bit more, like we have to reckon with the origins of this because we inherit it and we're having a really big conversation right now about what we want that to be going forward when there is such systemic racism and such systemic police brutality and the world is stopped. It's a good time to have that conversation because nothing about the world right now is business as usual.
I'm thinking how strange it must be for you. You know, when you were in the process of writing Hamilton, the Obamas had you to the White House and you performed it. You performed like part of the opening song. And, you know, you're still working with the Obamas on various, you know, like fundraising
efforts.
The voter
initiative, yeah.
Yeah, and now you are so opposed to the president. This is the president who threw paper towels at people after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, where your family is from. So it's just this like whiplash, I'm thinking for you, of going through, you're a friend of the president's to now like, you so oppose the president.
Yeah, and you know what's even crazier? Our show is about that too. You know, Hamilton dies, and every single one of his opponents becomes president for like the next 20 some odd years. It's, yeah. Well, Adams, who he was never a fan of and didn't like him either. It was Jefferson, then Madison, then James Monroe, who he almost got into a duel with, but we didn't have time to get into it in the show. So that whiplash is also part of the reckoning that we're having as a country. But I also, you know, I never bought into the illusion that the Obamas being in the White House ended racial issues in our country. Just the same way I used to get the question all the time in that first year of, now that Hamilton's here, do you feel like Broadway will be more diverse? And I was like, no, because shows take years to develop and I know what's in the pipeline and it's not. Next year is going to be even whiter than this year was. We landed in an incredible year that included Shuffle Along and Allegiance, lots of different types of representation in that particular season. But again, I gird myself for the whiplash in both the country and the particular corner of the world that is theater.
So your father has been, or maybe still is, in politics. He worked with three New York mayors, including Ed Koch. So you grew up with a very active political father. So did you grow up with a sense of how politics is productive, it's good, it's a great process, or did you grow up with a much more cynical sense of it, where it's about power, it's about ego? Like, which version?
I don't think that those are exclusive. Those are right. Mutually exclusive versions of politics. Certainly, my dad represented a lot of Latino officials. I think the work he was proudest of was trying to get Freddie Ferrer elected. You know, we think a lot about alternate timelines, right? And I think my dad still mourns the alternate timeline when, you know, the events of September 11th happened. That was primary day. And for Borough President Ferrer had the momentum to win that primary, and it didn't happen. Who knows how it would have turned out? But even before my dad got work in politics, he was a community organizer. He was very involved with the school boards in our neighborhood because he really wanted to make sure my sister, who was 6 years older, could get a good education in our neighborhood. And so my experience of politics was like kind of being dragged to meetings. You know, it's like when it's take your kid to work day, I'm coloring in the corner while strategy is being discussed. So, you know, it's sort of a mix of all of it.
You know, I think for anybody who is the child or grandchild of immigrants, there's always this question of like, how do they have the courage to leave, or were they forced to leave? And then come to America? And did they know English? And if they didn't know English, how did they get by? It's so much harder to learn a new language when you're an adult as opposed to when you're a child. And when your father left Puerto Rico, my understanding is he didn't really know much or any English. Do you know what it was like for him to come here and try to find a place for himself without the language?
Yeah. And listen, my dad had it better than most. My dad came here on a scholarship. He was a prodigy. He had graduated the University of Puerto Rico by the time he was 18 years old because he'd skipped grades. And he got a scholarship to NYU. He moved in with an aunt who lived in the village. He remembers practicing English with his cousins who were 6 and 8 years old, and he felt like that was the level at which he could practice his English and not get made fun of. He was very grateful for that 6 and 8 year old, and the resonance of it back in my life is amazing because I have three cousins who grew up in Puerto Rico who I adore more than anything in the world, and they are 12 years younger than me, and they're the ones who call me out on my terrible Spanish in the other direction. But I think a part of me is always in awe of the immigrant experience. I'm a living testament and a beneficiary of my dad on my dad's side and my grandparents on my mom's side coming to this country and making a better life for themselves. And that to me is one of the things that are founding that is worth celebrating, that people come from all over the world, and when they give this country their energy and their focus and their work, our country is richer for it. And there's a lot present at the founding that is not worth celebrating, but that promise to me is one of the things that is.
What did it mean to you to be Puerto Rican when you were growing up?
It's funny because, you know, I went to a school with not a lot of other Latino kids, I think one other Puerto Rican kid in my grade. And so it was this, you know, for me, it was this fantastic secret. And my parents were so proudly Puerto Rican and so pro, like, learning your heritage that, you know, I was proud that I got extra Three Kings Day on top of Christmas. I may not have the 8 days of Hanukkah, but I got Christmas plus one on January 6th. That's how you experience it as a kid. And then I also, you know, would spend my summers on this beautiful island where my grandparents both worked. My grandmother ran a travel agency and my grandfather was a bank manager. And I bounced between their businesses, eating candy and left to my own devices, exploring town, and was sort of spoiled rotten in this incredible landscape. But again, I wasn't going to the beach every day. I was just soaking up small town life in, you know, my dad's small town of Vega Alta. So it felt additive, but it also wasn't something I brought to school much. And I think a lot of In the Heights was me learning to bring all of myself in the room. I let most folks call me Lin. My parents and my wife call me Lin-Manuel. And a lot of what In the Heights was about was bringing Lin-Manuel into the same room where Lin was writing musicals and sort of using all of myself to write.
In the Heights is set in the same neighborhood that you grew up. Would you describe the neighborhood when you were growing up?
It was and in many places still is, a little Latin American country at the top of Manhattan, with weird Irish signs everywhere because the Irish were in the process of fleeing the neighborhood. And my dad had a nanny in Puerto Rico named Edmunda Claudio. And when I was born, she moved from Puerto Rico to help take care of my sister and I. And she never spoke a word of English her whole life, but she didn't have to in our neighborhood. And we could go from business to business in English or Spanish, whether it was the candy store or the library or the supermarket. And I was on her arm, and or the local bodegas. And it was a place where we could all be understood. And a lot of In the Heights is about writing from that place of love, of loving the fact that, you know, it was a largely Dominican neighborhood when I was growing up, a huge Dominican influx in the 70s, but you also saw the Puerto Rican and Cuban waves of immigration that came before. And so In the Heights is about that, those stratified waves, and how we make a neighborhood special. And we, you know, because gentrification, we sometimes, you know, make it so special that, like, we can't afford to live there anymore.
Obviously, you are a very busy person always, and you always have a lot of projects, or you're deep into one project. And now that you're at home, you know, because of the pandemic, are you able to have the level of engagement and busyness that you typically do? And is your mind going in different directions because you are in a quiet space outside of your children, probably? But like you said earlier, you don't have the hustle and bustle of, like, Manhattan all around you. You're not on stage. You're not flying to different places in America or other countries with productions. You're not on a film set. So is your mind in a different place right now? And is that leading to new ideas or to reframing things?
I'd love to be able to tell you that I am writing King Lear or the sonnets now that the plagues have closed all the playhouses. I'm afraid I can't, because I'm as worried about the world as anyone else. I think I wake up with stomach aches more often than I don't, because mm-hmm. I worry about what's going on. I worry about my city reopening too soon and having a second spike. I worry about the protesters and hoping they're okay. And I worry about, I worry about all the things everyone is worried about. And I find that because I'm home, it is harder to, because I can't physically distance myself from my particular bubble, like, distance myself from those thoughts either. And I think that's okay. Like, the world is being remade in a fundamentally different way because of this pandemic and just because of where we are. And artists have to give themselves the latitude to, like, acknowledge that. So give yourself a break if you're not writing right now. I do find that the self-imposed deadlines and even projects of my own where I say, okay, I'm going to write this and I'm going to have it by Friday, allow me to push the world away and do that. But I actually find it harder when you're just sort of sitting with it than, you know, being able to take a train ride and clear your mind or walk with your dog.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, it's really been great to have you back on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I wish you and your family good health.
Likewise. Great to talk to you.
Lin-Manuel Miranda created the musical Hamilton and wrote the book Music and Lyrics. A filmed version of the original Broadway production with the original cast, including Miranda as Alexander Hamilton, is now streaming on Disney+. A documentary about the improv music group that Miranda co-founded in 2005, Freestyle Love Supreme, will start streaming on Hulu July 17th. My guest Christine Baranski stars in The Good Fight, a legal drama streaming on CBS All Access that recently concluded its fourth season. Christine Baranski started her career in theater and went on to co-star in the TV series Sybil and The Big Bang Theory, and films including Reversal of Fortune and The Birdcage. She's been in several stage and film musicals, including Chicago, Mame, and several by Sondheim, including Into the Woods, Follies, and Sweeney Todd. Christine Baranski's character in The Good Fight is Diane Lockhart, who was spun off from the series The Good Wife. Both series were created by Robert and Michelle King. Diane is a progressive, smart litigator who's a partner in a law firm. The first episode of the first season of The Good Fight opened with Donald Trump being sworn in as president, a grave disappointment for Diane, who had planned on celebrating the election of the first woman president. The first episode of the latest season opened with Diane waking up in an alternate reality where Hillary Clinton was president. The Good Fight frequently incorporates stories that have become part of the national conversation, like white supremacy, police assaults on black men, the alleged Trump golden shower tape, powerful men who are accused of sexual assault, and an attorney general who is criticized for bending the rules to benefit his allies. Christine Baranski, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Terry.
You know, a lot of the shows you've done, are comedies, and there's social comedies, but there's a lot of political material in this. Is the feedback that you get from viewers different because of all of the politically related storylines in it?
Absolutely. The show was not conceived to be a show about life in the Trump era. It just so happened that on election night we were shooting the pilot, and it's a well-known story by now that Robert and Michelle had to rewrite and reconfigure the pilot to accommodate that new reality. But it transmogrified into a show that is possibly the only show on television that is about people living through this dystopian era. And I get a lot of feedback from people who are just grateful to see a show that reflects their own sense of disorientation and confusion and how they're coping with this, crazy age.
You know, the show has tried so hard to be in the moment and topical, but it could not have foreseen the pandemic, and the season had to end early, right? Didn't you have to stop production because of the pandemic?
Indeed, we did. And as I'm listening to this scene that you just played between myself and John Larroquette, it's chilling to hear those words, because those words were written before the Michael Flynn news story of, the attorney general dropping that case. And for my money, it's our best season ever, because it does go to the heart of who's enabling powerful people to get away with corruption.
Audra McDonald co-stars on The Good Fight, and of course she's done a lot of music theater. You and Audra McDonald and Meryl Streep did a song together for the Stephen Sondheim 90th birthday tribute, which was streamed on TV because this was during the pandemic, so everybody basically recorded in their homes. Was this your idea to bring the three of you together? You'd work with Meryl Streep and Mamma Mia.
It was. Audra and Meryl and I have all worked with Steve. We adore him. And a year ago, we took him out to dinner. And we vowed that we would do it again. When he turned 90, I emailed him to say, Steve, the three of us want to get together with you and have dinner. But alas, we're stuck. And maybe we'll do it, in virtual reality somehow. And a week later, I got the call from Raul Esparza about the fundraiser. He asked if I would sing something. And of course, I thought, well, yes, of course, how could I not? And he said Meryl was a part of it. And I'd always wanted to sing Ladies Who Lunch. So the song popped into my head, but then it popped into my head almost at the same time that wouldn't it be fun if Meryl and Audra and I shared the song as a way of getting together, quote unquote, with Steve to sing this for his birthday instead of having dinner with him. So it was an idea, and Meryl went along with it, and then we got Audra involved. So we each did our part. I had to do my stanza and my, phrases. At the end of the day, when my grandchildren were asleep, Meryl had to do hers, in California, and Audra was in her country home. And so we all recorded. We had the same track. And then it was edited and sent out there. But I was delighted with the reception because it was sort of my idea, and I thought, oh my God. The night before it streamed, I apologized to them and I said, sorry for getting you into this, but you know, it's for Steve and he'll get the joke and at best it'll be fun. So the fact that it went viral and people were really talking about it and that I'm talking about it now is a really happy ending. But mostly it raised money for artists striving to end poverty. And I think Steve was utterly delighted with it. So, you know, mission accomplished.
Well, let's hear how it came out. We'll hear the stanza that you open with. And then we'll hear a little bit of Meryl Streep coming in right after. So this is my guest. Christine Baranski starts off this song.
I'd like to propose a toast. Here's to the ladies who lunch. Everybody laugh. Lounging in their caftans and planning a brunch on their own behalf. Off to the gym, then to a fitting, claiming they're fat, then looking grim, 'cause they've been sitting, choosing a hat. Does anyone still wear a hat? I'll drink to that. Here's to the girls who stay smart. Aren't they a gas? Rushing to their classes in optical art.
So that was Christine Baranski with a little bit of Meryl Streep, and the percussion you hear with Meryl Streep is her, at least part of the percussion is her shaking the cocktail shaker, because all the ladies in this are drinking.
We each chose our choice of alcohol. So mine was red wine. And then it cuts to Meryl shaking a martini. And then Audra has a tumbler of whiskey.
You were in the film Mamma Mia and its sequel. And in addition to singing in that and, you know, of course, doing comedic acting, you have a dance scene on the beach where you're not only dancing, but like you're getting lifted by men, by men, male dancers. And I don't know how much like dance you've studied over the years, but I always wonder what it feels like to, you know, be lifted like in one of those dance lifts. And then, you know, like you're like moving your legs in like a graceful way. And it always feels like I hate being picked up. So like tell me what it feels,
you know,
like to do that and
of...
to learn how to be like graceful when somebody's like, you know, holding you up in the air like that.
Well, I think if you were on a beach in Greece and there were a lot of really hot young men, you might get used to it. You might find yourself enjoying being lifted up. Let me just say this. I started I was sent to ballet school at an early age, and I thought I would be a dancer rather than an actor. So my primary training as a performing person, young person, was in ballet. And then I studied modern dance, and I was part of a workshop in Buffalo where we were doing African-American dance and modern dance. Anyway, when I applied to Juilliard for acting, I also wanted to study dance, and they told me you can't possibly do both disciplines. So I had a lot of dance training. And when I did Mamma Mia, I, of course, started studying, went back to it. When I played Mame, I had to do a lot of dance training as well, you know, in preparation for anything you're going to do. So by the time guys are lifting you up and spinning you around and you're having to move your arms and legs around, I did enough preparation for it. But the funny story there is that we had rehearsed that musical number months in advance while we were still in London, and then we were filming all these other scenes at the soundstage in London at Pinewood, and then we went on location in Greece. So this was months later. We're finally on location when the director says to me, you know, the weather is perfect and I think tomorrow we're going to do Does Your Mother Know? And they had just flown in the guys the night before. And I hadn't reviewed that number. We hadn't had enough re-rehearsal. And suddenly we were on the beach, and in order to create a platform for the guys to dance on, they cleared the sand, laid a concrete slab, and then covered it with sand. And these young men had to dance basically on concrete that was covered in sand. And it was just punitive. And we were filming it with, you know, we had to get the shot in. The sun was directly in our eyes. And anybody who's done movie musicals knows, especially if you're on location, how many challenges there are there. And there were wasps at that time of year. We had to stop filming because the wasps go mad and people were being stung. So when I look at that number, I don't think, oh, how, what fun to be on the beach with those guys. Wasn't that fabulously sexy? It was like, oh, I remember the wasps and the sun in my eyes, and I was squinting, and they were grinding their knees into the concrete, and, you know, all of the obstacles. But anyway, I guess we pulled it off. It's a fun number. It's the only number that's sort of a rock and roll number with the guys, and I absolutely loved it.
Your grandmother, if I have this right, was an actress or just a devotee of music theater?
No, my grandparents, both of my paternal grandparents, were actors in the Polish theater. I grew up in a suburb of Buffalo, Cheektowaga, but there was a very active Polish community and theater. And so they did plays and musicals in Polish as well as English. And my grandmother, I never knew my grandfather, died before I knew him, but my grandmother lived with me when I was a child up to the time my father died when I was 8, and then we moved away from my grandmother. But we shared a bedroom, and I always say she was a anti-MAME influence in my life. She loved music, she loved dance, she had a vivacious personality, and she even had her own radio show on the Polish radio station, and she wrote a comedy hour with her friend. This is where I guess my love of theater and perhaps my talent comes from.
Well, and also the idea that you could actually become an actress because you shared a bedroom with one.
Yes, I did. And she was very theatrical, and she had very theatrical friends. They would come over and just, I could hear them. You know, we would be put to bed, my brother and I, but Nana was in the living room with her Polish friends, and they'd get drunk and they'd sing and they'd dance. And, you know, as I said, she was really rather an anti-MAME type. And, but she had a great effect on my life. And when my dad died, when I was 8 years old, we moved away from Nana. And it's only years later that I realized what a profound effect that had on me, my early years with her, and also the loss of her, how traumatic that must have been for me to have lost someone who was so loving and physically affectionate and fun to be around, because my own mother was not that kind of person at all. My mom was raised during the Depression and wasn't terribly physically affectionate. And I have no memory of my mom reading to me or sitting on my mom's lap. It wasn't that she was really cold. It's just she wasn't like my Nana.
So you grew up in Cheektowaga, which is a suburb of Buffalo. Is it fair to say it was a kind of industrial suburb of Buffalo?
Well, there were some factories, but it wasn't. It was very much on the outskirts of Buffalo, but no, not that far in the suburbs. I was within walking distance of my church and my schools, and I you know, walked to Mass every day. We had to hear Mass every morning, and it was a Polish Catholic upbringing. And my mother worked in this air conditioning factory called Hudai that made parts for air conditioners, and she was something of an engineer. My dad worked at a Polish newspaper in Buffalo until the time he died. And he died of an aortic aneurysm when he was 49 years old.
Mm-hmm. So you got a scholarship at Juilliard. And the way I've read it reported in the press is that you got a $1,000 scholarship because you were the most hardworking, economically needy student. Did they literally say that?
They certainly told me when I got the scholarship that they knew I was in need financially and that I was to use the money to live on the following year. And I think the next day I was in the passport office getting a passport to Europe and spent all the money traveling around Europe alone for 2 months.
Did you feel just a little bit guilty taking the money that was meant for you to enable you to attend Juilliard and instead traveling to what, France?
I traveled to London, then I went and took the ferry to Paris, and then I traveled through the Alps to Switzerland and then to Italy and then to Greece, and I didn't feel any guilt whatsoever because it was one of the greatest things I've ever done. To this day, I will tell you that it was one of the greatest things I've ever done and one of the gutsiest because I was a young woman alone. I was 19. I was staying in the cheapest hotels, you know, walking the streets of Paris and Rome and just discovering all of these extraordinary, I would spend hours in museums and sitting in the cheapest cafe and just thinking it was the most romantic, incredible thing. And it informed me as a human being. And so, no, I have no guilt.
Well, Christine Baranski, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much. I wish you and your family good health and sanity during this crazy time.
I wish you the same, and thank you for your questions. They were very deep, and I was glad to rethink about a lot of what you brought up.
Christine Baranski spoke to us from her home in Connecticut. She stars in the series The Good Fight. Season 4 recently concluded. All 4 seasons are now streaming on CBS All Access. Our interview was recorded May 27th.